We really appreciate the opportunity to be here at the Camrose United Church for Ms. Ronning's center consultation. Professor Faulkner was for many years, 29 years if I recall, 29, 30 years, professor of religious studies at Dalhousie in Halifax. I have known him as, in my own sense, is that he has a wonderful Protestant liberal mind, complex, deep, and that he is worth engaging on so many things. I'm particularly delighted that he has become part of the advisory council of the Chester Ronning Center, and we will have a chance to work together over the next few years. Professor Faulkner currently teaches as part of the Faculty of Theology at the University of Winnipeg in Manitoba, and anybody who's ever been at Portage and Maine knows that this is sort of spring compared to Portage in Maine in July, the coldest spot in North America for some odd reason. Professor Faulkner brings a wealth of experience to his teaching, his writing, and he has himself had a history with the military, and has thought and taught about it all the way from, as he said to me earlier today, when the ancient Greeks invented war, down to our own day, and thought about the church's position in it and how we can hold together those extraordinary traditions of just war and of yieldedness, as the Mennonites are fond of calling it. So I'm delighted you're here with us tonight, and thank you so much for coming.
Thank you very much, David. It's a very kind introduction. I'm just delighted to be here, and for the Camrose United Church's hospitality, especially grateful. If I'm so deep, you may ask, why can't I get PowerPoint to work for me? I am living proof of the adage that power corrupts, but PowerPoint corrupts absolutely. I tried to fit it all on a screen, and it didn't actually get there. And Debbie's going to try to bail me out by turning the screen at the appropriate moment. Just don't tell my daughter what this looks like, eh? She's been using PowerPoint for years and can't understand how I could mess it up. Well, for if the trumpet give an uncertain sound, who shall prepare himself to the battle? This passage, 1 Corinthians 14, verse 8, has been frequently quoted by members of the United Church of Canada, who are critical of the direction being given to the church by its leadership in times of war. My purpose tonight is to begin a critical examination of the trumpet and how it has been employed. Throughout the 20th century, the community that became the United Church of Canada in 1925 has confronted the problem of war, and the trumpet that sounded has sometimes been uncertain, sometimes altogether too certain for its own good. When I first started reviewing the record of my church in this matter, that's very much my church, I became indignant at what seemed to me to be all too often a record of hypocritical failure. But as I went on, I came to the conclusion that the notion that the failure is there because the leadership is hypocritical is just plain wrong. That's not a valid explanation. As I went on, I came to the conclusion that there are two reasons why the efforts of the United Church of Canada to rise to the challenge of war have been notably unsuccessful. And neither of these two reasons is adequately characterized as hypocritical. I may mention just in passing that war is very much a part of the symbolism of any religious tradition, and of our own in particular. And I don't know what the story is behind it, but we have a stained glass window hanging over us tonight of a saint in full armor. I presume it's St. George, am I right? Anybody tell me who we've got up there? It's visible from the outside because the light's shining out, but there's no sun to bring it in. Does anybody from the congregation know who we've got in the stained glass there? No, eh? Okay. Interesting. Well, but I'll be back for another paper on that one. So. It's one of the clergy. Well, then it's not St. George. Incidentally, St. George was a pacifist, but he's the patron of warriors. That's another story. The second of the two reasons why the United Church's trumpet has been uncertain. The second of the two reasons has to do with the peculiar sense that the United Church of Canada, which is my church from birth, and surely my church until death, or until the United Church develops a practical means of excommunication. The United Church of Canada has a sense of itself as, in a peculiar way, committed to social justice. And I think it's this commitment to social justice and the way it's committed that that really is the great problem for the United Church in confronting war. And I'm going to spend most of tonight's time trying to develop that point. So it's something that's peculiar to the United Church because of its social justice interests. And if you could figure out that last point under this last third bullet, that arrow that seems to be meandering off somewhere belongs with the notion that with the gospel, the United Church sees that it has to unfold as social justice. It's necessary. People in the United Church can't make any sense out of the notion of a social gospel. It's the gospel. And of course it's social. Now, the first reason that the church has not done well on this is a reason that applies, I think, to all Christian communities. Indeed, it applies to all religious communities, not just the Christian ones, and it applies to all the governments that value peace. In general, neither the religious communities nor the governments really understand the unique nature of war. And they repeatedly fall into error because they think of war as just one more political problem, however difficult it may be. Second one, Debbie. I consider politics to be the highest of all human arts, and certainly the most difficult. Politics has to do with human beings living together intentionally, constantly making choices that sustain and enhance their community. And in my experience, politicians, which is an English word that derives from the Greek word for city, politicians are more altruistic, more devoted to service than the typical citizen. A word, by the way, in English that derives from the Latin word for city. In all too many instances, that may not be saying much, but I insist that the greatest achievements of the human race, as the human race, are the achievements of what Aristotle called political animals. Now, in every realm of human experience except one, there exists a sovereign authority to whom we turn when we want to know right from wrong, when we want to know law. The exception is the realm of war. The great modern classic of war, by von Clausewitz, the great modern classic of war defines war as the continuation of politics with an admixture of other means. But the point was made with more pithy eloquence by the foundries who cast cannon for the United Kingdom back in the 19th century that bore on the barrel the slogan, "The King's Final Argument." Because what happens in war is not political discourse. It is the imposition of a human community's will on other human communities or beings by organized violence. So what is it, if I may add the next screen, What is it that religious communities and governments misunderstand about war? There are two things, basically. And the first point is that they misunderstand the purpose of warriors. By the way, David didn't mention that we're going to have an opportunity for comment and question at the end of this. So when I finish saying these outrageous things, don't think that I'm just going to walk out of here and you're going to have to sit on it. If you have something to say, then there will be lots of time for that, and I hope to engage you. So what governments and religious communities misunderstand is that warriors aren't there to kill people. Sun Tzu reminds warriors that death alone is irreversible. Just about any other human action can be reversed. So you can try it out, and if it didn't work, you go back. But when you've killed somebody, that's it. You can't fix it. And Sun Tzu reminds his warriors that whenever you set up a battle plan, you must always leave a route for retreat for the enemy. Never trap the enemy and annihilate them. Von Clausewitz teaches warriors that their purpose is to destroy the enemy's ability and will to resist, not to destroy their lives. Those who say that warriors are essentially disciplined killers are wrong. War is violent conflict between disciplined groups, and warriors who defeat their enemies know that success is achieved when defeat is an event that occurs in the mind of the enemy commander. Warriors also know that success is rare, and that the longer combat is prolonged, the less likely it is to succeed. Combat that is prolonged always ends in failure. That's what warriors know. Many warriors contend that one can end a war without losing it, but that winning a war is not possible. And all warriors know that if they stay long enough in combat, they will cease to be human. That is why all the great warrior epics, without exception, across cultures and down through the ages, end in tragedy rather than victory. And most of our modern storytellers have forgotten that. I may mention in passing the abomination that is the Hollywood movie by Wolfgang Petersen, Troy, completely distorts the Iliad, which surprises me because Petersen made one of the really truly great war movies, Das Boot, that does authentically render what war is like. So combat always ends in dehumanization for the winners as well as the losers. The second thing that religious communities and governments misunderstand about war is that it is the state of human existence in which there is no sovereign political power. Only by exiting war and entering into another state of human existence, any other state of human existence, only thus can human beings be political. In every state of human existence except one, human beings use political means to devise ways to live together. Only in the state of war do human beings use means that are not political. If von Clausewitz is right, they also use some political means, and maybe that's where the confusion comes from. If you got some political means, maybe they all are like that, but it's not so. In war, we use means that are not political. Thomas Hobbes knew this back in the 17th century when he described human beings who cope with the state of nature. The state in which everyone is a wolf to everyone else, in which there is war of all against all, and in which life is mean, nasty, brutish, and short. This is unfair to wolves, by the way, but I think you get the idea. Hobbes described how people devise an earthly god whose sovereignty they then acknowledge. And he named that earthly god Leviathan, a name from the Hebrew Bible that refers to the dragon in the deep, a fierce and mysterious monster. Do you not find it remarkable, as I do, that a sincere Puritan Christian like Thomas Hobbes should advocate idolatry? I see this as a measure of Hobbes's horror at his experience of war. My point is just this. War is the end of politics. It is the end of civilization. Only by exiting war is civilization possible. Only by exiting war is the art of the possible made possible once more. Yet religious communities and governments repeatedly address themselves to war as if war may be civilized, as if going to war can in itself achieve a political goal. When religious communities and governments enter into war, they conduct themselves as if they are wrestling with just one more political problem. And when they are at war, they blow their trumpets, confident that the sound that they produce is certain. Warriors, on the other hand, know that religious communities and governments are wrong. Warriors know that the fog of war is pervasive in war. The fog of war is not intermittent, and it is certainly not susceptible to elimination. Now, I may not have persuaded you that war is the one and only state of human existence that is incapable of being civilized, the one and only state of human existence that is not susceptible to political management. But perhaps I have persuaded you that I myself sincerely consider war to be so. And therefore, I at least am no longer surprised when the trumpet that the United Church of Canada sounds in the face of war is defective. I expect such efforts to fail because they fail for all religious communities and governments that act as if war is just one of many political problems. Let me set the stage for the second reason why the United Church of Canada errs when it addresses the problem of war. The reason that has to do with my church's traditional commitment to preaching and living a gospel of social justice. For United Church people, religion is never just a private matter. Because our time here is short, and the historical evidence is vast, I want to focus on the Second World War, an event whose misleading name blinds us from seeing that it really is just a continuation of the First World War with a 20-year interruption. It's really not a different war altogether. Now, during the 1930s and the 1940s, the General Council of the United Church met once every 2 years. The United Church of Canada is the most centralized and tightly integrated major Christian denomination in Canada, much more centralized than the Catholics and the Anglicans, for example. And the General Council brings together hundreds of voting delegates who have been elected from regional and local courts of the church to debate and define policy and to hold accountable the staff and volunteers charged with helping the church as a whole to realize those policies between meetings of General Council. The General Council of the United Church of Canada is, in the best Aristotelian sense, a very political event. At every meeting during the 1930s, everyone, General Council carefully affirmed its considered conviction that war is contrary to the teachings of Jesus Christ and the will of God. Now, of course, virtually every other church authority in the world was making the same assertion during the 1930s. But in 1938, the General Council of the United Church of Canada made a particularly thoughtful pronouncement in which it drew explicitly on the Oxford Conference of 1937. Now, the Oxford Conference was a gathering under the auspices of the Universal Christian Council of Life and Work, a body that later became part of the movement that was crucial to the formation of the World Council of Churches in 1948. In 1937, the Oxford Conference condemned war, and then it affirmed that there are three positions on war that may legitimately be taken by those who are Christians. The first is pacifist rejection of all wars. The second one is support for a just war that vindicates Christian principles. And the third is submission to the state's call to arms, provided that the Christian is not absolutely convinced that the state's reasons for going to war, its casus belli, that those reasons are immoral. So it's three possible positions, and each one is authentically Christian. In 1938, the General Council considered, among other things, the conclusions of the Oxford Conference, and after much amendment and counter-amendment, General Council affirmed the rights of both the Christians who are pacifists and the Christians who take up arms in a just war. Interestingly, they dropped that third one about submitting to the state, provided you can't really see that it was all that wrong. In the spring of 1939, events in Europe were looking distinctly unpromising for peace. And in May, the King and Queen paid a coast-to-coast visit to Canada that many understood as a way of preparing Canadians for the renewal of the conflict that had ended in 1918. The Toronto branch of the Fellowship for a Christian Social Order, the FCSO, responded by bringing the celebrated Anglican pacifist Canon Charles Raven to Canada for a lecture tour at the same time. Don't move. Hitler's invasion of Poland on the 1st of September in 1939 introduced blitzkrieg, lightning war, and left even those opposed to war with the expectation that the war must widen to include most of the countries of the world. On the 3rd of September, Britain declared war on Germany, and in an unprecedented display of independence, Canada declared war 7 days later after a debate in the House of Commons. However, the Reverend J.R. Muchmore, who was secretary, and therefore think of him as the chief civil servant, full-time staff member, secretary of the Board of Evangelism and Social Service of the United Church of Canada, convened several informal and formal meetings in Toronto at the headquarters of the United Church of Canada in late August of 1939, even before Britain had declared war, let alone Canada, and before Hitler had actually invaded Poland, to consider what actions the church should take in light of world events and the resolutions of General Council. Muchmore summarized the findings of these several meetings in a letter that he sent out to all the ESS conveners, and there would have been one of these in every presbytery in the country. And he sent it out on the day that Hitler invaded Poland. So he was ready, right off the mark. In this letter that Muchmore sent out, he quoted the 1938 General Council resolution saying that war is contrary to the mind of Christ. That is an expression that may strike some of you as odd, but think back to the passage of the New Testament that many scholars think is probably the very oldest passage in the New Testament, and that is the hymn that's quoted in Paul's letter to the Philippians, chapter 2, verses 5 to 11, talking about putting on the mind of Christ as how you become a Christian. Muchmore, having quoted the resolution, then raised two rhetorical questions. First, what is the immediate and practical value of such an ultimate ethic? And second, what dangers are inherent in its pronouncement in such a day as this? Muchmore's summary of the advice from his meeting said nothing at all about the position of absolute pacifists who reject participation in any war of any kind. And his letter put strict limits on the selective, conscientious objection to particular wars, warning, for example, against basing conscientious objection solely on what he called the private judgment of the individual. And furthermore, he pointed out that the conscientious objector isn't going to be liable to legal proceedings unless conscription comes along. Now, this is a very important recasting of the General Council motion and a deletion of important elements in it, if we can move to the next one. It was also, in my opinion, quite disingenuous. In 1939, Canadian conscientious objectors, commonly referred to as COs, often demonstrated their loyalty and their sense of communal responsibility by enlisting in the Canadian Armed Forces and then insisting on their right to be assigned non-combatant duties. Most modern armies, 90% of the soldiers don't get into combat. It's only special forces units that tend to be 100% in combat. Furthermore, we know in hindsight that conscription wasn't imposed in Canada. Quebec would have nothing of it. It wasn't imposed in Canada until late in 1944, really as an act of desperation by a prime minister who thought he faced a literally faced a military coup from the West if he didn't do this. But it was late in 1944, so there was no conscription until that point. There were, however, university campuses where undergraduate males enlisted in the Canadian Officer Training Corps, the COTC, as part of their studies. This was true in Saskatchewan, the heartland of the United Church's social gospel movement. And the head of the federal government's war services program in Saskatchewan squared off in public against the president of the University of Saskatchewan in disagreement over how to treat the conscientious objectors within COTC. The judge who was heading up the War Services Department in Saskatchewan for the government wanted the COs thrown into jail. And the president of the university wanted the COs to be given alternative service as non-combatants. Now, this issue became particularly acute for six COs who were in the midst of their studies at St. Andrew's College, the Theological College of the United Church of Canada in Saskatoon. The Canadian government preferred to send COs off where you couldn't see them anymore, sent them off to isolated camps such as those in British Columbia where they could plant trees. But the theology students wanted alternative service that would bring them into contact with the immediate dangers of war. A couple of them, Keith Woolard and Harvey Clark, engaged in some truly canny and apparently experienced political lobbying and got themselves assignments to fire brigades in London during the Blitz. But another one of these COs, with the name of Gordon Toombs, reports that he was not so fortunate. Toombs interrupted his theological studies at St. Andrew's College to enlist in the Canadian Army in 1939. He would complete his theological studies after the war at Emmanuel College in Toronto, spend 15 years as an ordained minister of the United Church before going into graduate studies in counseling at the Menninger Clinic. He became a counselor at the University of Manitoba and one of those who shaped the Canadian Association for Pastoral Practice and Education, CAPE. But at the outset of the Second World War, Toombs sought assignment to non-combatant duties as a conscientious objector in the Canadian Army. Next one, please. 2 days before Canada declared war, the moderator had issued a pastoral letter to the clergy of the United Church of Canada affirming, quote, the paramount authority of conscience under the leadership of Christ. A declaration that some clergy took to mean that the church was prepared to stand behind those of their ranks who chose to take a stand as conscientious objectors. And indeed, Gordon Toombs had the active and open support of the principal of his theological school, St. Andrew's College, even though the principal himself supported the war effort. I am, by the way, seeking permission to publish similar accounts of COs and their mentors from Alberta. But I haven't got permission to do that yet. Rough outlines are the same as what happened to Toombs, but in some ways livelier and more complex. Well, the moderator's letter had been prepared following discussions of Muchmore's memorandum for the ESS meetings that he sent out when Hitler invaded Poland, meetings that laid plans to mobilize local congregations in support of the troops, knitting socks, preparing care packages, what have you, but plans that studiously ignored support for the conscientious objectors. And Gordon Toombs received no support for his stand as a CO from any courts of the church. After nearly 2 years of army indifference and occasional hostility to his requests for alternate service, in which he was accused of being a communist, Toombs, I find this hard to believe, Toombs went AWOL and volunteered for the RCAF. The RCAF took him in because the Army and the Air Force were completely separate in those days. And they didn't know that he'd been a CO for two years hanging out in barracks and quarantine in the Army. So, unfortunately, the Air Force had to wait a month before it found space for him because they hadn't geared up fast enough. So Toombs went back into the army, served his time in detention for being AWOL, and then went AWOL a second time and was admitted to the RCAF again, and this time immediately sent for training. He asked his CO for non-combatant duties, and the CO said, you know, we just don't need any people in non-combatant anymore. The thing we need is air crew. And Toombs, who was sincerely opposed to the war but had been cooling his heels in barracks and despised and not able to do the alternative service that he felt he ought to do as a citizen, said, okay, take me as air crew. And he ended up as a navigator flying bombing runs out of England on Germany. He ended up in the same squadron where my father was the squadron warrant officer. Now, my point in offering these details is that the COs from theological colleges of the United Church of Canada during the Second World War displayed a keen sense of their responsibilities as citizens of a country endangered by war, while insisting on their right to give service as non-combatants. Particular leaders of the United Church who held high office were willing to give active support to these COs, even though they themselves supported the war effort and would have preferred to see their theological students emulate the example of, say, the Reverend Donald Mathers. Mathers was a newly ordained United Church minister in 1939 who was offered a position as a military chaplain. He turned it down and instead served as an officer in an artillery battalion. In 1962, Mathers was a theological professor at Queen's and wrote the book that is probably the most important theological work in the United Church in the 20th century. I refer to The Word and the Way, the basic book for the new curriculum for the Sunday schools that was developed in the 1960s and published 100,000 copies here in Canada. It was a guide to the Christian life that would ring strangely on our ears today. Every congregation I know has several copies of this buried in the back of their Sunday school cupboard. Have a look at it sometime. What you'll see is that the central organizing metaphor for it is war. The last page says, the Christian life is like this. D-Day has happened, but we haven't had victory in Europe Day yet. Now, my point here is that there should be no doubt that the United Church theological students who became COs in 1939 actively sought alternative service in its most hazardous form, but they did it without the institutional support that the church gave to the war effort itself. I consider it significant that the church placed J.R. Muchmore in charge of the national office's dealings with those COs. The most dramatic demonstration of the church's indifference to its self-proclaimed responsibility to support its members who objected to the war came in response to the Witness Against War, published in the United Church Observer on the 15th of October, 1939. Over the signatures of 68 United Church clergy, these were not theological students who hadn't been ordained yet. All of these men, and they were all men, were holding pulpits. It had been drafted by the Reverend R. Edis Fairburn, a notable pacifist, and he had been assisted by active members from the Fellowship of Reconciliation, an international body that brought in the English-speaking world and the German-speaking world together after the First World War, and also from the Fellowship for a Christian Social Order. Not all of these people were pacifists, but they were all opposed to the war, and they supported those who were COs. Let's put the declaration in context. First of all, by the time of 1940-42, people in Canada were genuinely terrified that Hitler was going to win and that Britain would fall. But in the fall of 1939, they didn't see it that way at all. In fact, like the people in Britain, they were used to calling it the phony war, because it, you know, there's all this Sturm und Drang and Poland fell, but then nothing else, and it all grinds to a halt. So Poland had fallen, but in 1939, the Brits, the Canadians, thought this was the phony war. Second, though, the Canadian government, as opposed to the Canadian public, wasn't sanguine about the war. And the Canadian government moved deliberately to quash all opposition. The French-speaking Catholic mayor of Montreal was arrested for speaking out against the war in public, convicted, and put into a prison in Ontario. The signatories to the Witness Against War in the United Church openly declared their respect for the rights of others to choose to support the war. But the signatories insisted upon their own spiritual obligation to refuse to support the war effort. They cited the position taken by the General Council in 1938, and their concluding word on the matter was, I quote from up here on the screen, or at least partially, "We profess our readiness to implement our citizen loyalty in some form of service equally as taxing, difficult, and dangerous as military service, providing it doesn't contribute directly to the war effort." I just want to pause here and underline that this is not an empty offer. Since, for the last 100 years or so, the balance has shifted in war. It used to be that more combatants died than non-combatants. But now it's more non-combatants who die in war. And it has to do with the nature of technology in war. The weapons are more powerful, but they're less discriminating. And the difference is increasing. That is to say, non-combatants, the more we improve our weapons, the more likely it is that non-combatants will die. So when somebody volunteers for alternative service as a non-combatant, it's not exactly a safe place to be. Sometimes it's safer to be among the warriors. Except that the second greatest cause of death of warriors now is friendly fire. And that also has to do with the technology. Well, when the number of signatories to the Witness Against War rose to 75, including a moderator, a former moderator of the United Church, the Attorney General of Ontario approached the General Counsel staff in Toronto and pointed out that this public declaration violated the law, violated the same law that had led to the imprisonment of Mayor Oude of Montréal. Sub-executive of General Counsel met on the 25th of October, and this is a large group, 25 or 30 people, and they composed a statement that dismissed the Witness Against War as unrepresentative of the church as a whole. I think we can move to number 9, thank you. Dismissed it as unrepresentative and contrasted it with the presbyteries across Canada that had already expressed themselves on the war in terms of loyalty rather than pacifism. See, both groups, the pacifists, the COs on the one hand, and the opponents, their opponents, both use the word loyalty. The pacifists grant that the other types are being loyal. But the folks who are against the conscientious objectors do not grant that they're being loyal. They contrast these, the CO with the loyal person. Saskatoon Presbytery, within which St. Andrew's College is located, was one of those that passed resolutions of this sort. The sub-executive noted that it had already established a National War Services Committee, that 150 United Church clergy had already volunteered to serve as military chaplains, and that 500 local war services committees of the United Church were already hard at work, with another 1,500 expected to start soon. "We are therefore confident," they said, "that we but express the attitude of the United Church of Canada as a whole when we declare our regret at the action of the signatories in making their manifesto public. The Church is determined to adhere to its previous declarations that it will protect the individual conscience, but in our judgment, by acting collectively and inviting signatures for later publication, the signatories of the manifesto, however sincere, have gone far beyond the limits of what is wise and proper in time of war. Even the appearance of organizing opinion against the tragic necessities of the community cannot but jeopardize the essential unity and fellowship of the church and the nation." The sub-executive would take this opportunity of proclaiming afresh the entire and unfailing loyalty of the United Church of Canada to His Majesty the King, and its steady purpose to support him in the present dire struggle in every way which is open and proper to the Church. As I read this, you can be a pacifist in the United Church of Canada as long as there's not a war on, and as long as you don't proclaim it. This statement by the sub-executive was published prominently in the United Church Observer on the 1st of November, the same day in which the Attorney General of Ontario held a press conference in which he affirmed that the witness against war violated the Defense of Canada regulations, but he recommended that the Church's own governing body discipline its dissidents in lieu of legal action by the government. Professor R.B. Y. Scott, who was Canada's most distinguished biblical scholar of the 20th century, and one of the two clergy who had helped the moderator draft his pastoral letter of the 8th of September, published a letter in the next issue of the United Church Observer in which he lamented, "The text of the sub-executive statement is indeed not quite the complete repudiation suggested by the press, but in effect it is a desertion of our comrades who are under fire because they have made an unpopular witness for conscience' sake." The whole tenor of the official statement suggests that the Church's reputation for loyalty to the military enterprise of the state is a more important consideration than that of loyalty to religious conviction. The signatories to the Witness Against War continued to meet, and they pressed the National War Services Committee of the United Church of Canada to embrace their proposals for pacifist programs in parallel to the programs in support of the war effort, but they were rebuffed at every point. Now, the failure of the United Church of Canada to support the theological student COs and the clergy signatories to the Witness Against War stands in contrast to the support given to J.S. Woodsworth, leader of the Cooperative Commonwealth Federation, or CCF, in the House of Commons. And I want to draw this contrast because people might say, well, what else could they do in time of war? Woodsworth had ended 22 years of service as a Methodist minister in 1918, charging that his church, later to become one of the principal partners of the United Church of Canada, wouldn't permit him to preach pacifism. Woodsworth, by this time, was head of the CCF, which of course later becomes the NDP. Woodsworth met for 3 days of private debate with his caucus before the House of Commons convened to consider the Prime Minister's call to war on the 8th of September. The CCF caucus unanimously repudiated Woodsworth's pacifist opposition to the proposed war. But then they granted him the right to be the first to speak in the House following the Prime Minister's 4-hour address in support of a declaration of war. Woodsworth declared his firm opposition to war, sat down, and continued to hold his position as leader of the CCF. I want to draw attention now to an ingenious scheme to support the war effort that the United Church of Canada put into action later during the Second World War. Ingenious, well publicized, but in fact a failure. As the Second World War got underway, the United Church of Canada was carrying a deficit of $1,700,000. This was the legacy of church union, in which practically all the Presbyterian clergy joined the new church in numbers disproportionate to the numbers of wealthy lay supporters who tended to stay out. So you had all the staff on salary, and all the people who'd been contributing to it unfortunately went the other way. And on top of that, after the church union, there's a decade of economic depression. So they've got a big deficit. $1.7 million doesn't sound like much today, but believe me, it was then. In July of 1940, while Canadians followed with rising horror the news of the Battle of Britain, the Canadian government launched its War Savings Certificate drive. The government proposed to sell $120 million worth of War Savings Certificates in order to finance the war effort. Citizens could redeem each of their $4 War Savings Certificates after 7 years and get $5 back for them. The sub-executive of General Counsel met with the Minister of Finance in the government in Ottawa and developed a scheme in which they would canvass United Church members under the slogan, "A loan to my country, and a gift to my church, urging United Church families to purchase war savings certificates and then donate them to the United Church to wipe out its deficit. The government would take the money to build bombs and tanks, and then 7 years later, $5 would come back for every four invested to wipe out the church's deficit. The normal circulation of the United Church Observer at this time was 17,000 copies for every issue. The issue in which they developed this campaign on the 1st of March 1941 came to 200,000 issues, and it was really completely devoted to the war savings campaign. Well, largely devoted. Similar campaigns arose in other Canadian denominations, the Baptists, the Anglicans, the Catholics. They all did it, but they did it retail. It was in local congregations and parishes. Nobody else, only the United Church of Canada, put the effort on a national footing and in a major way. Now, the next issue of the United Church Observer to come out carried a motion, a report of a motion adopted by Vancouver Presbytery, calling for clarification of, and I quote, the seeming inconsistency between the pronouncements of the General Council on War up to 1938 and its present endorsation of the campaign to sell war savings certificates. Charles Clayton Morrison, who's the Canadian-born editor of the Christian Century, a liberal Protestant magazine of comment published out of Chicago, for which I had the honor of being the Canadian editor-at-large for a while, the Christian Century in 1939 ran an editorial. Morrison had been a tremendous admirer of the United Church of Canada. When it was formed in 1925, he'd written an editorial saying, this is the biggest thing since Pentecost in Jerusalem. He was an enthusiast. But here he is in 1939, and he's saying, one cannot help fearing that the involvement of the church in financing the war will, in the long run, weaken its Christian witness. The Canadian government formally asked the United Church sub-executive of General Council whether Morrison's editorial was detrimental to the War Savings Certificate campaign. The sub-executive replied that it rejected the editorial, but it didn't feel that the Christian Century should be banned from circulation in Canada at this time. More telling is the actual result of the campaign. In a country in which boys with paper routes were saving enough money to buy several $4 war savings certificates from the government, members of the United Church of Canada, and we'll go to number 11 if you would please, members of the United Church of Canada had pledged only $500,000 by June of 1941. That's approximately one $4 war savings certificate for every four families in the church. In April 42, the organizers of A Loan to My Country and A Gift to My Church reported that less than half the deficit had been covered. What explanation did they give? They opined that there was too much competition from other war savings certificate campaigns, that United Church members were unenthusiastic about paying off an old debt, and that some United Church members didn't believe that the United Church national debt was real. But to this they added, and I quote, the apparent indifference of so many of our local leaders, our local church leaders. The campaign was finally wound up 3 years later, having at last reached an amount equal to the church's deficit. But the total still represented sales of less than one full $4 certificate to every family on the rolls of the United Church. And none of the reports, interim or final, cited opposition to raising money for the church but by loaning money to fund the government's war effort. Other explanations were mooted officially, but never the possibility that the people in the pews might feel that there is something inappropriate about financing the war effort through a church campaign. What do I conclude from this disappointing record, if we could go to the last screen? I grew up admiring J.R. Muchmore and those like him, and I rejoice in the commitment to social justice that is characteristic of the United Church of Canada. Individuals such as the principal of St. Andrew's College upheld the formal position taken by the General Council in 1938 when his theological students rejected his own support for the war and declared themselves to be conscientious objectors. But the formal church bodies charged with implementing the resolutions of General Council did not act according to the declarations in support of conscientious objectors when the war actually broke out. And those same officials covered up the failure of their efforts to blend church fundraising with war financing. It seemed to me that the sub-executive of General Council and their staff should have actively defended the rights of the COs to be assigned alternative service, and should have actively defended the signatories of the witness against war against prosecution for taking a public position. I might mention they should have defended the mayor of Montreal, but who would dream of doing that? I don't make this assertion because I think that such action was the right thing to do, although I do think it was the right thing to do. I make it because the 1938 General Council had plainly adopted a policy that defined such action as right. And furthermore, it seems to me that the sub-executive should have publicly acknowledged their failure to persuade United Church members that the campaign to eliminate the church's debt by selling war savings certificates was a bold and brilliant Christian strategy. They should not have blamed their failure on the indifference of the local church leaders. I offer these critical judgments because I think that the sub-executive's failure to take such actions undermined the effort of the United Church of Canada to proclaim and live social justice. The United Church's reputation for commitment to social justice cannot rest solely and securely on the examples of a few individuals who do the right thing when a crisis arises, interspersed with well-worded resolutions adopted during periods of quiet when discipleship is cheap. At the 1948 General Council, 3 years after the war ended, an effort was made to persuade the Council to adopt a new resolution recognizing both pacifism and the just war position as authentic Christian positions on war. I'm a parliamentarian. It boggles my mind why they had to do that. If you have a policy on the books, that's your policy until you remove it. But you know, they moved it as if it had never been done before. Both pacifism and just war. But this time, the resolution was sent to committee for further consideration, and it returned many months later in a form that seems less supportive of the right of pacifists to bear witness in public, and more concerned that if the pacifists do that, it will damage the unity of the church in itself. Perhaps this is progress of a sort, but surely it would have been better for the integrity of the United Church if the motion had flatly repudiated the behavior of the sub-executive during the war years, or even simply repudiated the pacifist position itself. I don't see the sub-executive of General Council as behaving hypocritically in 1939. I rather suppose that their consciences had led them to conclude that the General Council had been wrong in 1938, and that the COs and the signatories to the witness against war were wrong in 1939. But then the right action for the sub-executive would have been to resign. Instead, they substituted their own judgment for that of General Council, undermining its authority and undermining the democratic process that reached it. And they discouraged the COs and the signatories of the witness against war, who were trying at considerable personal cost to stay in good relationship with the United Church, knowing that the majority opinion was contrary to their own. Likewise, the sub-executive of General Council missed a teaching moment, both for themselves and for the people of the church, when they chose to ignore the opposition to a loan to my country and a gift to my church, and blamed instead the failure of the campaign on the local leadership. By its proclamations and by its lived example, the United Church of Canada seeks to answer the gospel's invitation to seek the kingdom of God. But this is a political task, and it requires church leaders who are prepared to serve the church by implementing its policies rather than by substituting their own whenever they come to disagree with the church's policies. Now, if the church leaders are bound by their own consciences to disagree with church policies, then they should resign, putting their witness to the dictates of their conscience ahead of their own status. Church members are not brought more closely into the kingdom of God when their leaders ignore the responsibilities placed upon them by representative church courts, and when their leaders ascribe their own failures to their people instead of to themselves. Democracies do not progress because enlightened leaders tell the people what they should have done. Democracies progress when leaders exert themselves to do the right thing and are then held accountable for their actions by the people. For what they doubtless thought to be good reasons, the official leadership of the United Church of Canada behaved, and I use this word in the political sense, they behaved irresponsibly by failing to defend the rights of COs and the signatories to the Witness Against War in 1939, and they compounded their failure during 1940-45 by pressing ahead unapologetically with a campaign to end the church's debt with money raised to finance the war. Many of those who feel called to leadership of the church are attracted by the example of the prophet who speaks truth to power, witnessing to the gospel by defying the king, the sovereign authority, at the risk of their own safety. But in a democratically structured Christian community, such as the United Church of Canada, a more difficult martyrdom is expected of the leader who must witness to the gospel by challenging the church's own perception of the truth. The democratically structured church learns from leaders who either accept their responsibility to uphold the church's policies or who resign rather than implement policies that they see as wrong. The democratically structured church learns from leaders who can acknowledge their own failures without shifting the blame to others. The leaders of the United Church of Canada sometimes forget that that is so. And they forget it when they confront the problem of war, and then the trumpet sound is uncertain. Too bad. War is difficult enough without the church failing to meet the most basic standards of democratic leadership: responsibility and accountability. For of such, fellow citizens, is the kingdom of heaven. I would be glad if anybody would care to add something to this or do their best to take away from it. And this is very much a first draft, and I'm here to learn from you. Yes?
Just a brief question there. In Canada, it seems like we've had less of the political use of war by religious communities in comparison to our neighbors to the south, where the war on terror, for instance, has taken on almost an overtly religious dimension. I'm wondering how the United Church of Canada feels about there may be formal statements which I'm unaware of about, say, for instance, Canada's role in Afghanistan and the political use of Canadian participation in war. Because you talked about war is not a political environment, and I'm wondering about the use, the political use of war.
Yes. See, I think when anyone, whether it's a religious community like a church or a government, tries to achieve a political goal by going to war, I think that's where we are destroyed by the character of war, because war is quite relentless on this score. I think that there is a time to go to war, and in fact I met for the weekend a couple of weeks ago with a group in the United Church that's trying to articulate a church response to the UN's responsibility to protect. And the responsibility to protect is basically an effort to enlarge the UN's mandate, that when you see, to really simplify what's a very complex thing, to use military force against those who are killing in job lots, we're talking genocide here, non-combatants, innocent people. And at the moment, the UN can't do that because it's a collection of countries, and each country is sovereign, and you don't interfere with somebody else's sovereign care of their citizens, but the responsibility to protect is an effort to change that. But that's not, see, that's not a purely political action. It calls for the application of military force to stop a military attack on innocents who are not being protected by their own government. And when you stop that, then it becomes possible, though not inevitable, for peace building to occur. I think it's a serious mistake to expect soldiers, warriors, to be peace builders. But they can break up organized military force that is attacking innocent people and who lack the protection of a state. The United Church of Canada has, I think, not really come to a clear position on Afghanistan. And that's doubtless because we're very divided on it. But I think we've been fumbling around it. And the way we fumble around it is there are some people who want to look at a very specific instance and take action on that. The responsibility to protect types are like that. Very well-defined moments will call for the application of military force. And then there are others who say, well, no, we can't just do that. We have to have a whole picture of what peace in the world would be, world peace. And we have to get that right. These are folk who are associated, I think, properly with the very interesting resolutions adopted at the last General Council against empire in the world. And there's merit to both groups. The problem with them is, if you go with the people who have the very specific question in mind, responsibility to protect, is that what's going on in Afghanistan? The problem with that is that if you take a very specific action, generally speaking, there are all kinds of unexpected results that come from it, very few of which are good. That's back to the fog of war bit that warriors all know about. On the other hand, if you wait until you have the blueprint for the New Jerusalem that's going to get rid of the evil empires of the world, Jesus will be here first with the second coming. And a lot of other people will be dead in really horrible ways before it comes. Do you feel responsible for that or not? A lot of people don't feel responsible for things they didn't directly cause. I'm of the opinion that we are responsible for those things. So I don't think the United Church has... Well, Canada as a whole hasn't done very well with Afghanistan, eh? If it has often been noted, especially by Mennonites and Quakers and other peace churches, that if people took the just war theory seriously, there'd be almost no wars. Because one of the things about a just war theory is that you go in only if you know you can win your objective without destroying everybody else. And frankly, how many military commanders have you heard report that we've got enough to do what they need to do in Afghanistan? And the Americans, of course, are arguing that NATO doesn't know how to fight a counterinsurgency war, and etc. So I think that Canada as a whole, it's not just the United Church of Canada, feels that it should do the right thing, but it's not quite sure what the right thing is. I'm one of those that just speaking strictly for myself, my sense is that we haven't sent the numbers and amount of military force that we need to send to Afghanistan. I think Rick Hellyer, the head of the Canadian command there, was saying we might be there for 20 years. And, you know, at this rate, yes, we could be, but 20 years in combat, you don't want to go there. It's not going to work. So I think we didn't send what we needed there, though we went with good intentions. And I have friends in the forces in Afghanistan. I support them, but we didn't really do that one well. And what happens then if we then pull back, as so many of my other friends would say, we know the war wasn't well planned, we didn't execute it well, let's just stop it. Well, if we do that, I know what's going to happen. Canadians are going to take a large step into isolationism and never think about doing this kind of thing again. So right now, you know, my most pious hope is, golly, I can't... This is awful. I'm sounding like Stephen Harper. I don't want to talk about the war. But, you know, I think, I do think that right now the most urgent thing for us to think about is the responsibility to protect. That issue could actually move the UN forward. The UN's got a lot of problems, but it could move us forward to a situation in which people in Darfur and Rwanda and Bosnia and would be protected. You know, the story of the Princess Pat Regiment in the Maduk Pocket in the former Yugoslavia is a good illustration of Canadians with courage who could really do something to protect people who otherwise were not being protected and were being systematically slaughtered. But we have to be serious about being committed to that. We have to will the end, and if we choose those means. So I, for my money, we really could do better to focus on the responsibility to protect. And then once we get our minds straight on that, talk about the Afghanistan conflict in the light of it. Because it gives us a framework to think about it that makes some sense.
Well, we've had two things going on there. And the one is to protect people. And the other one is to get the Taliban.
Yeah.
It's a slippery slope.
I find the Rwandan situation much more clear in my own mind, but that's because we've got a little distance from it. And I wonder if I could recount some of the issue as I see it there and how it might apply then to Afghanistan. In Rwanda, Roméo Dallaire was sent in with too few troops. He initially wanted, 100,000? And he thought maybe 20,000, absolute minimum 2,000. He ends up going in with a few hundred. He then gets reliable intelligence that there are literally tens of thousands of teenage boys who are being trained in camps in the backcountry in Rwanda to operate as units. And they're being trained to do something that human beings won't do naturally. You have to train people to be warriors. What these boys were being trained to be wasn't warriors, because they had no warrior's code that might mitigate their behavior. It was a particularly brutal pattern. They were trained to take machetes, take a family, and execute the children in front of their parents by chopping them up with the machetes, and doing it in a way that reflected a knowledge of anatomy and that would allow the children to suffer maximum pain and die maximum slowly. And then they'd take out the parents. So Dallaire knew this was going on. In those circumstances, in my opinion, the only thing that can stop those trained units is the application of military force. Because it's a truism that a group of warriors working together in a unified way will always be able to defeat greater numbers who are not so trained. And these boys were getting some training, enough to learn how to do this particularly horrible form of execution, which is not unprecedented, by the way, in human history. Some of King Herod's soldiers were trained that way back in the days of Jesus. They were doing it in job lots in Rwanda, and they knew it, and they needed to come in and break it up. Now, what would happen if you follow regular military doctrine is that the military would break up the unit cohesion of these boys, they'd fall apart, and then you'd go through steps to try to rehabilitate them. Roméo Dallaire right now is involved with a major project on child soldiers, trying to find ways to redeem those kids. And they should be redeemed. I mean, they're those little killers in Rwanda. Some of them are running with the mad cows in Winnipeg street game because we treat our immigrants so badly that they'd rather go with a street gang than live peaceably with the rest of us. They deserve redemption too, but I think none of them can be redeemed if they've actually been trained that way until you break up their cohesion with the military force. If you don't, then the only thing that will stop them is there aren't any more civilian families around to kill. Now, Dallaire saw that and he asked for help and he didn't get it. It looked like he was starting to get it when the British and French sent some troops in, but then when Dallaire wanted to use those to break up these gangs, he was told no. What they were going to do was simply draw the peace lines, and the effect of that was to allow the gangs to regroup in enemy-held territory behind those lines. So it actually preserved these killer units and allowed them to carry on. And there was more genocide, in fact, after the withdrawal of the UN. The guy who arranged that, by the way, was the head of Médecins Sans Frontières, who is now the foreign minister of France, Bernard Kouchner. And he did it because he's an NGO type that knows that getting peace means stopping the killing. So yes, just set up a line and stop it. But it left that particularly evil form of organized force an opportunity to regroup and start fighting again. And we know there was another genocide the other way, going back in Rwanda 2 years after the UN pulled out. So I am of the opinion that when there's a certain kind of organized violence that's ready to confront you, that the most moral choice in a bad situation is to send a military force against it. But you don't send one that's undersupplied or undernumbered. You have to send one that can actually do it in a short period of time. Because your own boys, and some of them will be women now, will be dehumanized if it takes too long to do it. So that is what makes sense to me. Does that make sense in the Afghanistan situation? Boy, that's even more complex than Rwanda, and I'm not sure that it does. It might, but I don't know. I don't know enough to... I do know what I would do if I could find that situation. I guess that's what I'm saying. There are very well-defined things that require military force, but a lot of things that we think the military can solve don't require military force at all and shouldn't be. Yes. It's just that I think the force we sent there isn't enough to actually defeat the Taliban militarily. If there's any way to deal with them at this point by diplomacy and negotiation, I'm all for it. But I don't think we, even with the Marines there now from the United States, I don't see that it's going to be possible to defeat them militarily. Part of the problem, I'm talking about things about which I haven't got adequate knowledge. This requires that wonderful oxymoron, military intelligence. But it's a truism, you know, in war that you never win a guerrilla war where there's a safe haven for people to retreat to and operate from their bases from. And Pakistan is that right now. Pakistan is a mess. The Afghanistan thing is not going to be fixed until Pakistan is fixed. And Pakistan can keep the Taliban from coming and organizing in Pakistan and going back and launching missions in Afghanistan again. Yes, Dietmar.
Who determines whether, you know, there's a situation, as you described in Rwanda, which sort of justifies or requires, let's call that, military intervention? Because one could see that, for example, the precursor to George Bush's government could decide, well, yeah, the Ba'athist regime in Saddam Hussein, you know, is destroying a lot of innocent people's lives, and so we are not justified to sell in military troops there. And now we have, as you're saying, the war itself is not a political tool anymore, and since they can't get out. So who determines, and who has the right then to authorize some military force to go in and protect people within a given country? So when a country's government and military, I guess, or quasi-military, are destroying their own people rather than protecting them, you know, who authorizes somebody from the outside to step in, and at what point?
I make a strict distinction, and classically warriors make the same distinction, between the decisions about going to war, the jus ad bellum, and the way you conduct yourself in war, the jus in bello. The warriors are the only people who ought to determine how you conduct yourself in war. But the sovereign power, in our case the people working through parliament, is the only one that has the ability to say, you go to war. The warriors should never be given that decision to make. And I alluded to that strange moment in Canada in 1944 when Mackenzie King, who was arguably the shrewdest politician of the 20th century in this country, literally was convinced that the army was going to pull a military coup and replace his government if he didn't call for conscription. He was particularly worried about George Pierce, who ended up as a minister in the Tory cabinet later on in the federal government. So the when a sovereign power starts to worry about whether the military is going to make those decisions, it isn't something that happens somewhere else. It's happened in our own history here in Canada. And I think we're going to see a lot of people die while we respect the notion of sovereign power. As some of you know, my daughter was in Kenya for 5 weeks in the most dangerous part of the violence that broke out there over Christmas. She was working at an AIDS clinic. And there were a lot of moments when I would have really been pleased to see the regiment sent over there to pull her out. Because it was quite obvious to me and to the NGOs on the ground and the local Kenyans that the Kenyan military couldn't protect people in that part of the country. But it would have been so bad if anybody from outside, let alone the Western powers, had gone into Kenya to bring peace and stop people from killing each other, as they are doing in increasing numbers right now. Because messed up as it may be, Kenyan democracy really, I think, has a chance to work, and it'll be set back terribly if we move in on them. So this is not one of the cases where you say, oh, there's organized groups who are killing people, and we could see that it was being set up that way even before Kate went over. The reports were coming out that bands were being organized. The biggest grocery chain in the country was not selling agricultural implements in job lots because young men were going in and buying 20 and 30 machetes at a time to take home to the farm. But there are people dying in large numbers there. But it's, you got to wait for the democracy to work. You got to wait for the people to choose the kind of government they want. And intervening in Kenya would be a big mistake right now. So who makes this decision? I think it's always got to be a sovereign political power of some kind. And what they're trying to do with the responsibility to protect in the UN is to reformulate how sovereign political power operates on a world scene to the point where you can invade some sovereignties. I mean, the question of, do you invade Darfur because the Sudanese government isn't protecting people? Do you invade Myanmar because the government itself is attacking its own people? That all will fall under this new rubric of the responsibility to protect. But there are a lot of other cases where we're going to see people killed in job lots like Kenya, and the best thing we can do is stand back and just hope the Kenyans can work it out for themselves. I think they can. And I think if we get in their way, it'll be worse. Anybody else? Yes, sir.
I was just wondering, you talked about the leadership of the United Church of Canada and how that if they disagreed with the policy before them, that's when the reformation would happen. And I was just wondering if you could talk about the possibility of leaders acting as organic intellectuals because the people that have wrote those policies were captive to society's norms and the policies might be wrong. Like, maybe not in the case of what we talked about, but in general.
You know, I see that as analogous to the question of should we go into Kenya because they're not protecting their own people right now. I think it's perfectly possible for someone to think that they were just dead wrong about that. But that doesn't give you the right as a person in a position of power and responsibility, I use that in the political sense, meaning you're answerable, it doesn't give you the right to act as if you were given one order but you're doing something else. Because it makes the voters, the citizens, cynical. It makes, you know, the little old lady who says, I never vote because it only encourages them? That's why a leader has to be prepared to say, I think you people out there made a mistake. I'm going to quote Edmund Burke back to you because I think he's a very important part of the tradition here. Edmund Burke, around the time of the American Revolution and the French Revolution, addresses the voters of Bristol and says, I intend to vote this way in the House of Commons. I'm a member of Parliament. And the voters of Bristol don't want him to do that. They're all opposed to it. And Burke says, I'm going to vote my conscience, and you can always vote me out at the next election. And they did. And that's the way it ought to go. If you think the people messed up, then you make that argument out in the open. Treat them as adults and make the argument out in the open and take your chances. And I am convinced, Lord Keynes to the contrary, said in the long run we're all dead, I am convinced that in the long run that makes people more responsible and makes the democracy more healthy. But if leaders go around saying, I know people just kind of messed up in this, they're kind of stupid. Well, Alexander Hamilton, from the Federalist Papers in the United States, the people, sir, the people are a great beast. If that's the attitude towards the citizenry, then that kind of intellectual arrogance doesn't build democracy. I'll give you one other thing to think about on this. Not very new political philosophy, but I'm really quite taken by Karl Popper's account of the enemies of the open society. Plato, Aristotle, they all thought democracy was bad. Plato wanted a philosopher king who could think carefully and prudently and wisely, much better than the people could. But I think that's an enemy of the open society. I think that way lies totalitarianism. I really believe in democracy. We're not very good at it. It's very hard to work. And if you think that you know more than the people does, maybe you do. But you got to be prepared to take your lumps. You have to be prepared to lose a vote. You have to be prepared to be removed from office. And that way democracy grows. Am I answering what you raised or am I missing it?
That's a pretty good idea.
Okay. Anyone else? Yes?
Maybe sort of a cultural question. I wonder if you think the United Church of Canada is a sort of micro of Canadian culture generally, or if Canada is a sort of macro of the United Church of Canada, conversely. I'm interested in the influence of the United Church of Canada, and particularly in its democratic identity.
John Porter, in his classic sociological work, The Vertical Mosaic, said that the United Church of Canada is as Canadian as the maple leaf. The maple leaf, of course, doesn't grow in many parts of Western Canada. The one on the flag is the sugar maple. And I guess that's really my answer, that in some ways it is very representative and in others it's not. All the churches, I think, have to really work to overcome a certain ethnic identity. One of my heroes, J.S. Woodsworth, founder of the CCF, Methodist minister for a while, thought that the way to welcome the men with sheepskin coats who were flooding into the West was to teach them how to be Brits. He wasn't really into diversity at all. I think that the United Church has to learn a lot about that. It has a moderator who's a lay person, it's had a moderator who's a black man, a moderator who's First Nations, a moderator who's a woman, but we still, in the United Church, I think still have the old patterns of power and ethnicity that have been with us for generations. So yeah, the United Church tries, but I think there's a lot more to Canada than just the United Church. Thank God.
Does the United Church have a policy for war?
Still got the 1938 one on the books, but yeah. There's a lot of work going on about this. My friend Roger Hutchison has been looking at the debate over the nuclear weapons in the 1970s at over UN interventions in the 80s. We're working at it. But as I say, I wasn't all that keen on the group I was working, I met with a couple of weeks ago. Now, mind you, they're just supposed to clarify things, and then the wisdom emerges from general counsel, and maybe that'll happen. But it's a big mess. And my own perspective on war, I go back to that first point, that governments and religious communities don't understand what war is really like. Now, maybe I'm wrong and war isn't really like that. But if it is, then we've got a pretty big problem that goes a lot farther than, I just wish the United Church of Canada would work a little harder on Afghanistan.
We want to thank Professor Faulkner.
Thanks a lot.
This gives us a lot to think about, and those of you who are puzzling about ethical issues for today, this gives you another whole range of ways of looking at our responsibilities towards violence in the world and what are the appropriate responses. In some ways, it seems, if you say both just war and pacifism are the authorized versions, I think we in itself, well, we're about as confused as Canada, I guess, on a lot of those issues. But that's exactly what we have to puzzle. I mean, what do we do, right? So what do we do with violence in the world? We'd like to live in an ideal world, and obviously it would be nice and lofty for us to all vote against war. Then how do you move towards that? I mean, it's a good ideal. So we have had consultations from people of the pacifist tradition, from yieldedness, who try to argue why we should, for example, withhold the war equivalent of tax in Canada, as making a strong statement about exactly the dehumanizing nature of war. So those are the issues. Okay, there are real conflicts. How do we engage? And Professor Faulkner has helped us to see some of the elements and of policy that a church tries to develop, but then also the uneven application of these policies. So how do we move from, you know, out of our religious convictions, this is where we should stand, and then once it plays itself out as our institution and our membership and our congregations or our faith communities, what happens in the process? So it was very enlightening to hear sort of a very specific case study of how one denomination has dealt with this issue. Which leads me to announcing, we're at a very important location here in Camrose. This is the only place in all of Camrose. There is a rush minute, and that happens on Sunday mornings because we have the United Church, the Lutheran Church, and the Roman Catholic Church, and so that's where you get traffic jams early Sunday mornings. But so we're not just favoring one side. The next major event of the Chester Rowning Center will occur on the other side, so don't get confused, or somebody can guide you graciously to the other side, over to the Lutheran Church on the 13th. Cynthia Molobida is going to talk about the church in public life. So again, the issue, how does the church engage, you know, political significant issues, in this case environmental and global injustices, and care of creation. And so that'll be on a Wednesday at 7:30 p.m. So Church and Public Life, Luther for the 21st Century. So in the particularities, in this case, of the Lutheran tradition, how do we wrestle? What does the tradition, what do the resources of the faith give us to address some of the global and environmental challenges that we are facing today? The following day, Thursday, it's a morning, everybody, we say it's a workshop for clergy and church workers. Any of you who are interested are invited. It will be up in Edmonton from 10 to 12. You can see it on our webpage. Go to the augustana.ca/Rowning, and then go under that, and you can find. And that's looking at exactly this year. How do you make religious claims in the public square? Which ones are appropriate, which are not appropriate to make, and how do you make the difference? So those are the two biggest things that are coming up. In a small way, for the early risers, before those events happen, next Monday, that's the 4th, right? Yes. 4th of February, right next door here somewhere is Merchants. David and I will do a public life cafe together with whoever happens to show at that hour to get a caffeine fix. But we want to look at reasonable accommodation. In other words, what should our society do in the face of religious ethnic, cultural differences, and how do you reasonably accommodate within, for example, you remember the issue of Sikh police officers wanting to work, wear a turban, right? So what is a reasonable accommodation? Quebec has faced this more than other parts of Canada, but of course we had hijab-wearing women playing soccer, and that was banned, and now it's back on again. So that's the issue. How do you accommodate? And, you know, the nice version is, oh yeah, we should accommodate everybody, but what are some of the consequences of that as well? So we want to have just a conversation over tea, coffee, or hot water. I'm sure it would be fine. So from 8 to 9:30 on Monday over at Merchants. For other program elements, you can go to our webpage again, or I think in the back we have some of these sheets, right, David?
Yeah.
Downstairs for coffee and conversation and or whatever else you drink at this time of day, you are invited to join Professor Faulkner. So thank you again for stimulating our thoughts. Yeah.